Welcome on to a Thursday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, following the Warriors riding the ship in a Game 4 victory over the Cavaliers. Joining us from the land of the midnight sun, Seth Partnow. What's up, Seth?
How's it going? It's not midnight here, but it is sunny.
Yeah, but, I mean, you're not going to get... You really are in, like, the perpetual, like, sunlight twilight period right now with it being June, right?
Yeah, it'll get dark sometime around late August, I think.
Yeah, all right. Well, I mean, I guess I can... this is the payoff for when I always make fun of you about how it's, like, getting dark at 3 p.m. during the winter, so I'm not allowed to be jealous. So, anyway... moving on to actual basketball rather than world geography, which I think people care slightly more about. What are your initial impressions on this game? I mean, I guess we could start with Kerr's gambit, if you will, starting the small lineup.
First of all, it was just surprising how late it came out. And I think in his post-game presser, one of the first questions was about that. He admitted straight up, "I lied," which I thought was...
I loved that. Yeah, me too. I loved that, yeah. Right? I always wondered, like, why guys are so accommodating with the media sometimes. And he actually sort of went through his thought process, which I really appreciate. He's like, "Oh, well, I could have, like, kind of obfuscated, and, you know, then there would have been all this speculation, or I could have, you know, just said we didn't know yet or something." He's like, it was easier just to lie. It's like, you know what? Yeah, like, just do what suits your purposes to win the game. Like, you have no obligation to the media. Like, despite the fact that, like, I am a media member, I don't think these guys have any obligation. Like, they're trying to win. I completely understand that.
Yeah, in a slightly other context, near and dear to basketball fans everywhere, he might as well have said it's all in the game. And that's you know, basically, you know, that was his basic answer, and I totally loved it also. But anyway, I thought that it was certainly a gamble. My favorite part about it was the game started... Well, on the scoreboard, the game started very badly for them, obviously, but they, you know, kind of liked what they were doing and kept with it. And I thought that was super important after the hot start that Cleveland got off to. Everyone was like, "Oh no, I guess that didn't work." Where, I don't know if you agree with this, but I loved the Warriors' first couple possessions of the game, even though they didn't make any shots. And I think that kind of carried through, and then they started to make shots, and we kind of saw the Warriors we've seen for, you know, 6-8 months.
Yeah, I thought so too. I mean, they were down 7-0 when Kurt called the timeout, and I thought the purpose of the timeout was almost like, look, the crowd's going nuts. We're actually playing pretty well here. Like, don't give up. Like, don't think that this didn't work. Like, it actually is working. Like, it's going to take an effect, because they missed two wide open corner threes, one by Barnes and one by Iguodala, and then the Cavs got two of their three buckets just by fast breaking and the Warriors not getting back. So it wasn't like they were just getting killed in, like, some unsustainable way. It was 2 minutes, and they stuck with it and basically, you know, played their centers for a grand total of, like, 3 minutes, and it worked out perfectly. I mean, and I thought it was great, because if those guys were all going to play terrible and not even protect the glass anyway, why bother?
Yeah. I also loved that their first possession of the game was something I think you were calling for, was just get out of the way, Matthew Dellavedova, you cannot guard Steph Curry in space. That was the first thing they did all game, and, you know, a little misdirection started off, and they went to that a couple times over the course of the game, and I think we were both, you know, happy from a this is a good strategy standpoint to see them not allow the Cavs to bring two people to Curry quite as easily.
Yeah, and it was nice. I mean, what they would do is they'd run floppy sets, and for those who don't know, a floppy set, basically we talked about, Ethan and I talked about what a pin down is, where a big sets a screen for a small player coming away from the basket, and a floppy set is where you do that on both sides of the floor. And so what that does is it occupies all four players, and that's when Curry is able to attack, because everyone else is worrying about that screen action, and if Klay Thompson pops open, we're going to need to have someone switch out of him, and that's why Curry was able to be, he wasn't that effective on those plays, but, you know, I mean, it's something they can always go to get a good shot, which they were not able to necessarily do throughout much of the first three games.
Yeah, exactly.
With all that said, I mean, do you really think the small lineup was the key here, or was it? Is there more that, you know, is that just a surface easy explanation for what happened in this game?
That's some of it. I think certainly on the Warriors offense, the small lineup really did, inject some pace and some movement into the game. Part of it was on the other side, Cleveland, who had been, you know, for all of games two and three, been so disciplined about refusing to kind of allow any pace. I don't want to say lost discipline, but they kind of maybe took some quicker shots than they have been. I mean, I think something we were both looking at is LeBron just seemed to have the ball less tonight.
Yeah, and you said there are some sport view stats on that he didn't nearly control it as much as he had in previous games.
Yeah, it takes a while for some of the stats to update, but right after the game, just number of touches, he had about a third of the Cavs' total touches in games two and three, and he had about a quarter of them tonight. And that's, you know, that seems like a small difference, but I think that's just a kind of a microcosm of, you know, he was just holding the ball and refusing to let anything else happen until he was good and ready in games two and three. And it seemed like they really got away from that aside from kind of the third quarter tonight.
You may not be able to remember this, but did they have more overall touches in the game? Like, were they moving the ball around more than they had been?
Yeah, he had about the same number of total touches they had. They've had in the kind of the low 300s for games two and three, and they had 400 some tonight in a game of roughly similar possessions.
That's fascinating because you would normally think, oh, the ball's pinging around. That means we're moving the defense. We should be getting better shots. We have better offense. And yet, you know, and I guess you could say they were scoring at about the same rate through three quarters that they had been. And then in the fourth, they just got, they were terrible. They had 12 points on 22 possessions. And part of that was LeBron missing the first couple first couple of minutes, and then also them just getting worn down as well. But, I mean, maybe that's not the case for them. Maybe they really are better just like ISOing every time. But I do think, though, some of the Warriors' strategic adjustments force them to play faster.
It's always tough. I'm always reticent to buy fully into a defense forcing stuff when it kind of takes two to tango, especially. And, you know, the Warriors weren't forcing Matthew Dellavedova to try to, you know, go one-on-one and shoot pull-ups reasonably early in the shot clock, and that happened. And they were certainly inviting kind of stuff like the Mozgov post-ups, which were, you know, fairly effective, actually. But so it's you know, forcing, allowing, encouraging. Yeah, they definitely did that.
Well, what one strategic adjustment that I can point to specifically was the way they defended the LeBron James screen roll with whoever Curry was guarding. They decided then that they were going to have Curry and usually Iguodala trap that. And then when they'd throw it to, usually it was Dellavedova or on occasion Shumpert, they would then just rotate another defender over and force those other Cavs to move the ball and make a play. And I don't think they got a single good shot that I can recall out of that James Curry's man pick and roll, which they had been quite successful with in previous games.
And that, I think that's actually where a little bit the small lineup for Golden State really showed its worth on defense is, you know, all year the Warriors have been great about, you know, switching and flying around and closing out on guys under control. And we kind of saw that once the Cavs were forced to move the ball, it was kind of in the Warriors' defensive wheelhouse a little bit.
So, you know, we mentioned, we probably actually skipped the biggest thing about the small lineups, me, and it wasn't necessarily that it was getting Bogut or, you know, or Azili or whoever off the floor so much as it was getting Iguodala on the floor.
He was fantastic tonight. He was great. He was aggressive. He actually didn't have an assist tonight, which is okay because he was really he's looking to shoot aggressively. I think I know you listened to the Zach Lowe Shane Battier podcast because you've heard to it, and Zach was talking about how when Iguodala is aggressively looking for a shot, it looks better and seems like it's going to go in more. And I certainly kind of felt that way about his shooting tonight. Didn't you?
Yeah, I thought on occasion he would not be guarded by Mozgov and would try to find somebody else. I mean, I think one of the big things they wanted to do, too, was when he had it and Mozgov was just laying off him, give it up and then set a screen and for someone like Curry or Thompson and then roll to the rim. They tried that. It was effective a couple times, not so much other times when the Cavs denied out on the wing. But, yeah, I mean, Andre was unbelievable. I mean, his defense was fantastic. And just the energy that he showed, pushing the pace, like on those two dunks that he had, he was just on a dead sprint, just beat everyone else down the floor. And like the energy to guard James for 39 minutes and to push the way he did in transition, he had a few other great pushes off the dribble. He looked like by far the most athletic, energetic player in this game tonight.
He and maybe not so much from the athletic, but certainly from the energy standpoint, I think that Sean Livingston also was really big in that regard. Didn't have quite the individually impressive stats. He was plus 25, a game high. Really did smart things, moving the ball around. Battled on the boards. He's obviously never a guy who's physically thick enough to really battle James, but made James work and possibly contributed to, I think, LeBron wearing down a little bit.
Yeah, 7 defensive rebounds for him, which is key. He's one of those guys who has to fly in from the perimeter and get the rebound when guys like Green or Barnes are engaged with the Cleveland bigs. So he was huge with that. I mean, I thought also starting Andre, he played 39 minutes, which is way more. And when he was coming in with 6 minutes left, number one, James was always able to get off early on Barnes. You're ensuring basically there's 12 minutes a game that Barnes was going to be guarding James. And then also you would have to have someone else on James when Andre would have to go out again for some rest. I mean, because he can't play 18 straight minutes.
Right.
So starting him and then matching him up almost exclusively with James worked extremely well also.
And I think that actually that helped Barnes a little bit too. He it wasn't a monster night from him, but certainly a better night. And he helped on the boards and hit some shots and actually got a couple of nice offensive rebounds too, which helped in the first quarter, I thought.
Yeah, this has long been kind of a pet theory of mine that, teams in recent vintage have kind of eschewed the offensive glass for trying to get back and stop the transition game. And I think that one of the key factors in the transition game is getting your bigs back so you have someone to protect the rim. So I think it's in some ways more effective to have your three-man or whoever crash from the perimeter where you're harder to box out when you get a running start and then have one of the bigs get back. And that's how Barnes was able to get all his offensive rebounds, was crashing in from the perimeter. And, it's really hard to box out someone who's got like a 20-foot running start like that and then can jump without getting a body out.
Yeah, that's an interesting theory, although I've kind of gone the opposite way. Sometimes teams that get give up a lot of transition, fast broken.
The Minnesota Timberwolves were fast broken.
Yes, exactly. Exactly the example.
That's a good one. I'm gonna start using that for teams with terrible transition defense. They are fast broken.
And the Wolves in particular are the team I'm thinking about, where a lot of it was because their wings would make really, if we're being generous, really aggressive attempts to go out at the offensive rebounds and had kind of bad floor balance. That's certainly something that I'm planning on looking at this summer. Digging into the numbers a little bit, but it's tough to say either way right now.
Yeah, well, the idea is that you're having one of your bigs run back immediately. So you're still sending two guys, but it's just that now one of them is crashing in from the perimeter rather than just trying to, like, already start out down low and try to get around a box out is the idea. So and then having a big back, I think, is more effective in some ways than having a wing back. But anyway, we're digressing
here.
So much will be made about the pace. However, this ended up as a 90-possession game, 91 possessions for Cleveland, 90 for Golden State. Golden State had, 102 points Let me scroll back. Yeah, 102 points on 90 possessions. So that's
the 114. Yeah.
And then 82 on 91 possessions for Cleveland, only a 90 offensive rating. Is too much going to be made of the pace given those stats, or are those stats kind of belie what was really happening?
I think some of it, the Cavs especially hit the offensive boards, and that slowed the, they had 16, I believe, and probably drew a couple more where they drew fouls. There's you know, at least the...
Yeah, I had four, either fouls or knocking the ball out of bounds off.
So that's 20 times they extended possessions, and I think that lowers the kind of the change of possessions count pace some. And it certainly seemed like the Warriors were playing faster. Even if they weren't necessarily shooting faster, they were playing faster. And it's hard to demonstrate that with just audio, I suppose. But, you know, it's something that Mike D'Antoni likes to talk about. It's not necessarily they're sprinting the whole time. It's that they're moving the whole time, and they're moving right away as soon as they caught the ball. And there was the couple times where they even got buckets right off of Cavs makes that they just weren't getting the first couple of games. And some of that is probably Golden State's, you know, kind of recommitting to playing fast, and some of that was maybe some fatigue setting in for Cleveland.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it too is that with Green at the five, he's setting the pick and roll. There's nobody under the basket. And so when they throw it back to him, then he can drive with an open lane. You know, whereas if they're throwing it to Bogut or Bogut has the ball on the elbows, he's not going to do anything other than just sort of like wait there for guys to cut off him and dribble handoffs. And the ball would end up sticking in his hands for, you know, 5 seconds or longer a lot of times. And they kind of got rid of that now. They're able to run the pick and roll, get it to Green quickly in transition. And then, of course, he had a much better game actually attacking the rim. He was able to draw some fouls on Mozgov, which people were complaining about wrongly, in my opinion. And he also hit his floater, which he said he worked on. And, hey, practice actually apparently paid off for him.
Yeah, and, you know, part of hitting the floater was it seemed like he was just a touch more patient. And maybe that's just, you know, being results-oriented that the shots happen to go in. But it seemed like first three games, you know, he would get the ball on the roll and just be moving 9,000 miles an hour straight at the basket. And he was just that a little bit. He was moving at, you know, 90% instead of 105%. And that just being that little bit more under control, I think helped him there.
I agree with you. Now, so we spent a lot of time on Golden State. Let's talk about the Cavs, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're all saying, oh, Golden State just play better. I don't necessarily buy that. I think that the Cavs really regressed just in their own game, having nothing to do with what Golden State was doing.
I'd agree with that. I mean, the Cavs shot 6 of 29 on uncontested shots is the early numbers. The Cavs perimeter.
That's insanely bad.
Yeah,
by the way.
It really is.
And 4 out of 27 on three.
Yeah, the Cavs perimeter guys, not LeBron, who didn't have a great game, but still they were. So Delly, Jones, Shumpert, and J.R. Smith were combined, was it 7 of 38? And you know, especially Dellavedova got some pretty open looks. You know, they got. You know, they weren't all great looks, but they didn't make many shots. Tristan Thompson continues to struggle to finish on putbacks. And then I think what you said earlier, I think that they allowed themselves to almost play into the Cavs' pace, the Warriors' pace a little bit by, you know, some other guys trying to do things with the ball that just wasn't happening. You know, there was, you know, a couple plays, even – like there, I remember a couple plays where Shump would like cross over and shoot like a runner, and he may have made even a couple of them, but still, it's like those aren't the possessions they were having when LeBron was just, you know, had an iron grip on the ball in games 2 and 3.
And they sent Curry more on the double teaming. Kerr did not acknowledge that in his press conference when he was asked about it. An intrepid reporter. It's always so bad for the reporters too. And like, I totally sympathize with them because, right, like we're watching the game. We see something, but you don't want to phrase your question as like, you did this, because then the coach, if the coach says, no, we didn't, then you feel like an idiot, right?
Right.
So you always will say, like, oh, well, it seems like da-da-da-da. But then you're, like, kind of unconfident, and it's even easier for the coach to deny it. So, like, you don't want to appear like you're an expert and get shot down. But, no, so some poor soul asked Kerr whether – and, you know, Kerr's obviously very friendly with the media normally – whether they changed up on LeBron, and Kerr's like, nah, you know, we didn't really. But that's just not true. Like, they did the stuff with Curry doubling when he was involved in pick and roll. And also Curry, especially early in that first quarter, helped out a lot on some of those ISO post-ups. And that left Delly open, and he was unable to make them pay.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say Delly was a victim of kind of some cumulative fatigue. You can't blame his performance totally on that. I mean, his performance was more due to the fact that, you know, he's Matthew Dellavedova, and he's not as good as the player we saw in Game 3 just in general. But I think it's to give him his due. I mean, he just did not have as much physically. I mean, you could tell when he had to come out of the game, you know, was it 3 minutes into the third quarter?
I mean, yeah, less than that. Yeah. Even. Yeah. After he got blown by, I mean, he made those two threes and you were like, all right, maybe he's got it going. And then he got blown by Curry and just like could not continue. I think, you know, he was cramping up again after having to go to the hospital after Game 3.
Yeah. That's mind is willing, but the body just not coming with him today a little bit. And to be fair, I think LeBron was suffering too. I think, you know, some of his decision making was kind of tired decision making. You know, again, part of him not getting the ball back and grinding possessions was, you know, it's hard work if a guy is bodying up on you to get the ball and go body to body with Iguodala for, you know, 20 seconds every possession.
Yeah, but you know, frankly, and I have one other question I want to ask about the fatigue thing too, but before I forget, I mean, this is basically the way LeBron has been playing when he's been guarded by Iguodala, right?
Yeah.
The entire series. It's just now he was guarded by him the entire game, and he wasn't able to – they didn't run nearly as much action to get switches as they did in earlier games, or Golden State just refused to switch and or changed up. You know, they wouldn't put Curry on him on those 3-1 pick and rolls. And, you know, so this is – you know, that's what he's been shooting. He's been shooting about 33%. On Andre, and that's what he shot in this game.
Yeah, and although I think we're probably focusing maybe a little much on James. I mean, he's the captain of the ship, so he, you know, is the first guy to get the credit, first guy to get the blame. But, you know, if some of those guys make some of those shots, then maybe that slows the help down a little bit and gives LeBron a little more room. I mean, you know, Mozgov obviously played a whale of a game. But if they hit even just a couple more jumpers early in the game, maybe, you know, Golden State has to slow stuff down a little bit.
Well, I mean, just a look at the stat sheet, I think, does show that one side or the other or both were operating differently. Because you remember, I mean, James has been basically around 40 shooting possessions this whole series. He had 27 shooting possessions, only 5 out of 10 from the line, too. He some big momentum-killing free throw misses as well, which you know, should probably be noted. But, yeah, so only 27 shooting possessions, and then you had 4 other guys who had double-figure shots, and then Shumpert with 9. So there was only one other guy who shot double figures in Game 3. That was Delly.
Yeah.
And so, there definitely a change was made, and it seemed to be working. So Blatt cited both in his comments to the team that were broadcast. He said, you know, we're going to get some rest. We'll be better after that. And then in the press conference, he was asked if they're tired, and he said yes. Did you see manifestations of that fatigue out there on the court?
Absolutely. Their transition defense wasn't as good. I think you see some fatigue in the jumpers not going in. Certainly, you know, Dellavedova's physical condition and LeBron's, you know, physical condition. I mean, there was about a 5 minute stretch sort of towards the end of the third quarter when he went back to the bully ball a little bit, but I'm not sure if he could physically sustain that for another game. So yeah, I think that, you know, and you know, this is also the first time all series that the Warriors kind of looked quicker to the ball. I think, Kerr brought that up in his post-game comments. Is, you know, tonight the Warriors seemed like they won the loose ball battles, and that was not happening in the first 3 games.
No, it wasn't. I mean, and when we talk about the fatigue factor, that's because we've had now, you know, going Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, three games in 5 nights, whereas before you have the 2 day break. I think the 2 day break versus the 1 day break, especially when you're flying, is pretty big. So and there will be 2 day breaks both before the next game and then before a potential Game 7, which is oddly enough going to be on a Friday night, if it does occur. But yeah, I saw that too. I mean, you know, you didn't see any of those signature Dele dive on the floor hustle plays. I think LeBron said that there were like 6 of those or something in the last game, and he didn't have any of those tonight. I don't think anybody really on Cleveland did, although, you know, they fought really hard in the offensive glass, Mozgov and Thompson. But aside from that, there weren't those type of hustle plays. And the Warriors had guys get on the floor. You know, even Bogut did. Green got on there a couple times. I mean, he said in his comments that, you know, he was failing in his role as kind of the emotional leader. And it was really good to see a guy make those kinds of comments, these sort of self-flagellating comments, and then actually live up to them and improve in the very areas that he said he was going to improve in.
Yeah, he definitely had, and it's a chicken or egg thing. You know, he saw the ball go in the bucket a couple times. You know, he had the and one, which I think some people questioned the foul call when he finished over Mozgov, and then he hit hit a big three, and that kind of, you know, it's tough to say whether he made those shots because he had the swagger back or he got the swagger back because he made those shots. But either way, he was kind of the same kind of chirpy Draymond Green that we're more used to seeing than kind of the slightly beaten down version from earlier in the series.
Well, and for those who don't know, by the way, those two fouls that people were complaining about on Mozgov, both of them were fouls. And the one thing that he's been doing a lot of that was an emphasis preseason, you know, the league will send around refs at the start of the year to talk to reporters in all the NBA cities and kind of explain what some of the emphases are. And I think that's good to do because you kind of correct any misconceptions, except, you know, this one seems to have not really been corrected that well among some of the reporters. But if you jump straight up and you turn your body that into the offensive player, that is still a foul on you. And the video that the league showed at the start of the year illustrating that, I believe, had like Roy Hibbert in it, because that was a big thing with him where he was on his verticality plays, he would turn sideways. And then on the second one, then he actually was jumping forward and turned his body sideways. So both of those were actually good calls.
I thought the second one was definitely a good call. The first one in kind of real time could have gone either way, but it's you know, that's a borderline call, and sometimes you get those and sometimes you don't. And that's actually something that's kind of it comes up every year, I think, is, you know, why is the officiating different game to game? And that's something I've never really had a problem with. I'm just wondering if you had kind of thoughts on that.
Because there are different referees every
game. No, but I mean, is that that strikes me as it's as long as they're, you know, within reasonable bounds of fairness and it's consistent within a game, I'm pretty much fine with, you know, a certain level of contact is, you know, it's a huge gray area between clearly a foul and clearly not a foul. And there's no reason to pick one spot or another on that continuum, but as long as it stays kind of the same spot the whole game, I'm fine with it. And if they pick a different, you know, spot the next game, as long as they stick with that, that's fine too, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, one thing that'll happen that a lot of teams will do that doesn't get much publicity is they'll send videos to the league of specific types of plays that they think are not being called correctly. And I said it in Game 3 too, that some of those Mozgov plays, because he was turning sideways into Green, should potentially have been fouls. And there are some rumblings that the Warriors made some efforts in that regard. So maybe that had an effect. Now, you know, some people might complain that that's lobbying and it shouldn't be allowed to happen. Other people would say, hey, they're getting the call wrong. Now they're getting it right. So, you know, you can think what you will about that, I suppose. I do think that the league actually does a pretty good job of being consistent. Most of my beefs with the way the game is officiated come from on high edicts from the league about how the block charge, for example, is going to be officiated. Let's not get started on that. We're already going to have one rant later about how stupid the cameraman thing is. But yeah, I think that's most of my beef with the league, is for sort of just the big proclamations of how
certain plays are going to be officiated rather than that individual refs are not that consistent. It's just not something that I focus on that much. And I think, you know, when you watch college, especially, or
right.
you watch like FIBA play or EuroLeague, I've been watching some Chinese league games to watch Moutier. When you see the how bad those refs are, you know, it's like democracy is the worst system in the world, except any other one. Hopefully I haven't used that line in the podcast before, but I think they do a pretty good job, to be honest.
I thought of you on one play. There was Steph kind of hit a runner, I think it was in the third quarter, and about 2 seconds after he released it, like he kind of lightly brushed into James Jones, who fell down, and they didn't call anything. And I imagined you just like your steam funneling out of your ears if they had called a charge on that play. So
yeah.
And then they didn't.
Yeah, like
so,
especially because yeah. Steph, like it's like 5 seconds after he's released
yeah.
the ball too, you know. So yeah, I mean, let's talk about that. James hit his head on a cameraman after kind of getting, you know. Not a ridiculously hard foul by Bogut, but, you know, he just kind of got sent flying
a
little bit.
It was a that is kind of the definition of a good playoff foul, I feel like, that ended, you know, unfortunately through no fault of Bogut's and through every fault to presage what you're going to say, every fault of how there's a million people within, like, 3 feet of the baseline.
Yeah, all right, so let me ask you this, like, why is it so important? That those people have to be.
You know, because if you move them back, then you lose a row of seats, maybe? I mean.
No, all right. Well, so, no, I'm saying my solution is, I mean, because overseas, you just don't have those guys there at all, right? Like, they're just, and it's so much, like, wherever you have them, you are putting objects directly on the ground, like, that are just essentially couldn't possibly be designed better. To have people trip over or sprain ankles on, right? Like you're putting an object, these reporters' knees and their cameras on the ground, hard objects. At least put like some kind of padding on their camera, like to start with. Like Livingston also, like you know, almost like busted everything on a camera later in the game too. But I mean, it's much different if you have just a row of seats there, right? Like you don't see players sprain their ankle when they go into the seats. On the sideline because those people are sitting up. There aren't objects just on the ground that are massive for them to sprain their ankles on the way there is with these cameras on the baseline. And I'm sorry, like it's just some photos because they're like right there. You know, they can't be three rows back in the stands. Getting that much better at photos is worth Chris Paul missing almost an entire year and never being the same after his injuring his meniscus in the 2009-2010 season. James, like, you know, cracking his head open, a sprained ankle pretty much every week in the NBA on the cameras. Like, it's just enough. Like, it's not important enough, and it's ridiculous.
You're not gonna, you know, you're not gonna. I'm, you know, I'm team ban the charge and team move him back. So we're in agreement on this one. I'm not gonna, you know,
Yeah, I'm sorry. It just like it evolved into this all-encompassing rant. I didn't leave like any ranting for you. I apologize.
No, it's okay. it was a righteous rant, and I adopted by
I mean, there's a ton of things you could do if it's really that incredibly important for TV to have a camera there. Just put like a remote control camera, in the basket, or you could have even you know. The basket stanchion could be like clear or something, and like the guy could be like right behind it.
The guy in the basket stanchion.
What'd you say?
Trapped in the basket stanchion, like the guy in the in the dunk pool at the carnival or something.
Han Solo yeah. like frozen in carbonite.
Exactly.
The cameraman. Yeah. But there are easy technological solutions to this. It really just like. If I were a player and I injured myself on that, I would just be so enraged. Like Aaron Rodgers had a great tweet about this too, like why these guys should be there. And you know, football players even like, you know, will run into cameramen on the sideline. And there's just, I just don't get it. Like whatever you think is so important, like every photograph that has ever been taken from the baseline in the history of the league is not as important to me as Chris Paul missing a season and never being the same afterwards. Okay.
Yes.
All right, we're done. So what else to say about the game, I guess we should look now at Cleveland.
Let's back up a little bit. Do we think that that play had any lingering effect on LeBron, or I kind of didn't think so. I kind of thought he just kind of wore down. I mean, I think he missed one of the free throws after that, and that maybe had an effect. But after that, I thought it was more just kind of, again, him whatever combination of rough game and fatigue was taking hold of him kind of went from there. And that incident didn't really, luckily enough, didn't necessarily play into it.
Nonsense. It's just a flesh wound.
I mean, it was disgusting, but, you know,
I don't think so. It's really, I mean, he didn't show any, like, concussion symptoms or whatever. And just, like, this speculation is just something that I think we've all said our piece on it. We don't know. I have no idea. It's just, it's gotten to the point where it's just not interesting for me to speculate as to whether a basketball player has a concussion or not.
Yeah, fair enough.
Like, I mean, he might or he might not, but you know what? Like, I frankly don't really have anything further to add to this debate on that issue. So, if that's what you're coming here for, sorry.
Sorry.
So let's get back to actual game analysis. We talked about the Cavs' terrible shooting. I mean, they're not this bad as shooters. I mean, Shump, Delly, J.R. Smith, those guys have hit their threes most of the playoffs, as the Atlanta Hawks and Chicago Bulls can attest. You know, those guys killed them with like random three-pointers. So, you know, I think that if this strategy continues for Golden State, that we may see those guys play a lot better. You know, the other thing that is not going to get talked about at all is Golden State had only an 8% turnover rate in this game. And that's about half of what the league average usually is. League average is usually like about 14%, I think. And so that was really huge. I mean, they didn't shoot an unbelievable percentage, at least not until the last quarter. But just by avoiding turnovers, they were able to be extremely efficient throughout the entire course of the game.
And actually, that they had four of those turnovers in the third quarter, and that was kind of when Cleveland went on their kind of their last little run. I think it was they had kind of three turnovers and about five possessions, I think, and that was kind of when Cleveland had their had some of their best moments off of that, I thought.
Another good stat for us here, we talked about the 4 out of 27 on threes. Cleveland was an additional 2 out of 18 on mid-range jump shots outside the lane.
That's not going to get it done.
So that what does that put them at? That's 6 out of 45 on jump shots. Is that right?
That's
6 out of 45 on jumpers in this game.
You lose.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, they were 17 out of 25 at the rim, and they got a ton of foul calls, especially in the second half. They were also 6 out of 18 in the paint, non-restricted area. So just, like, an incredibly bad shooting performance. They're not going to shoot that badly again. I thought that Golden State's defense, while it was good, was not, like, so unbelievable the way we've seen it at times in these playoffs, even with that small lineup. So I do think that Cleveland is definitely going to play better in Game 5, especially if they have some rest.
I think so. I'm wondering about – you talked about Shumpert specifically. I'm wondering if he was feeling any – because he was wearing the compression shirt tonight, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he bruised his shoulder. That's the same one that he – I said separated before. That was incorrect. He dislocated earlier in the year. So, yeah, I mean, he definitely did not look like he was in a great hurry to go inside. You know, he was pulling up. He's a guy who, you know, used to be a decent finisher at the basket in past years. So
no free throw attempts for him tonight.
Yeah, which – and not something that really happens that often for him either. You know, and Dellavedova, 3 out of 14. I mean, he'll probably make a few more threes. His two-pointers, though, were all terrible shots that you probably wouldn't expect him to make more of. And Smith was 0 out of 8 on threes. Like, he's – Klay Thompson has been doing an excellent job on him, but J.R. Smith is one of the supreme bad shot makers in the league. Like, you can expect him to make at least two of those 8 shots, no matter where he's shooting his three-pointers.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that, again, a lot of what the LeBron struggles kind of maybe seem less if people just make some shots. I'll be interested kind of when the Sport View stats come up tonight just to see how many potential assists he had. I mean, he had 8 assists, and just wondering how many, you know, chances that, that his teammates, usually it's about slightly better than 50-50. And if you get 8 assists, you probably had about 15 chances on average. And I'll be interesting to see if that holds, or if he had somewhere closer to 20 and guys just weren't making shots for him.
Yeah, no, I think that that's probably pretty likely. So any adjustments now that you see for Cleveland in the next game? I mean, when they're with such a short rotation, I'm not sure exactly what there is to go to for them, but does anything pop out to you?
One thing I thought that there, it doesn't necessarily show up in the plus minus or anything like that. I mean, they were, you know, -6 with LeBron off the floor, which is, you know, of course LeBron is off the floor, but I thought especially at the start of the, was it the start of the fourth quarter? They just had some really awful offensive possessions that were, I mean, someone who I followed tweeted and I retweeted it that, you know, they'd have been better off just, you know, kneeling basically and taking a shot clock violation, because not only were the possessions terrible, they were, you know, coming, the Golden State was coming right back down their throats, you know, because the possession would end with Dele hoisting like some mid-range junk with the other four Cavs on the baseline, and all of a sudden it's a 3-on-1 the other way every time. And so maybe that's, you know, maybe not necessarily finding ways to score, just finding ways to not have such disastrously ending possessions when, with, you know, those couple minutes they have to steal for LeBron, you know, each half.
One thing that I might do with LeBron is try to get him more rests, but just very short periods where it's not just like, okay, we have to survive, but it's just like, all right, we're going to do one or two possessions here. I think a lot of that's psychological too, where you just say, all right, you know, we've got the under 3 timeout coming here in the first and third quarters. I'm going to take him out with 3:30 left, and we're just going to go until the next TV timeout, and then we're going to put him back in. Just try and let him recover, because I think, you know, the way I've talked about this before, that the way that NBA players are rested does not really mesh with the way human beings recover a lot of times. And I think if you play a guy for so long, you can then get the tank on empty to where resting isn't necessarily going to help him recover. But if you take him out before he's just completely exhausted, he can kind of recover faster, get the tank back up to full, and then you just keep taking him out for short bursts like that. Maybe rest him like that just in 3 short periods and just tell everyone, all right, you know, we're going to milk the crap out of the clock here, and then just, you know, make sure we're not going to give up any fast breaks. And, you know, if we give up a couple of points, that's fine, but at least he's resting and we're not, like, getting killed during that period.
Yeah, I think your point you're making about, like, not redlining a guy is pretty important. Just letting, like you said, letting him recover instead of, you know, completely exhausting him. And I think that maybe we saw that with Dele a little bit, actually, in the third quarter. I mean, you'd think a guy coming out of halftime would be ready to go, but, you know, 2.5 minutes into the third quarter and he's just done again. So it's that's obviously, it wasn't something that happened in those 2.5 minutes that, that, you know, neither of us being exercise scientists, but I think we both know enough to to suggest that it's not those 2.5 minutes that, you know, put the tank on empty.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But in that vein, we do have to give Kerr credit for the key stretch of the game, which was when LeBron was out, and then when he came back in, they already had it rolling. It was down to 4, I think 69-65, at the end of the third quarter, and Curry would normally go out for his normal rest at the start of the fourth. Thompson had already been out. They know that's when James comes out. And for the second straight game, Kerr actually left Curry in. He played nearly the entire, probably would have played the whole fourth if it, or second, the whole second half if it had been close. So he left Curry in, left Thompson in, and they really just tried to blitz them when LeBron was out of the game. And I thought that worked beautifully for them. And, you know, Curry doesn't have the type of usage rate it didn't in this game where, you know, he has to get the ball every time. And so maybe it's more realistic to play him the entire second half in some of these games.
And I think that's also where, you know, playing Livingston a little bit more probably helped, because they were able to take Curry off the ball a little bit. And also,
yeah,
and probably also Dellavedova being fatigued to the point where he couldn't just, you know, be in Curry's space when he was bringing the ball up the floor and make him kind of burn energy that way. So I think those things both contributed to allowing Curry to, you know, have enough left in the tank to kind of do that. Like you said, they were, I just pulled up a wonderful website. Popcorn Machine lets you look at kind of stretches of the games pretty easily. They were over that first little stretch of the fourth, Curry got left in, they went on a 14-5 run over, you know, about 5 minutes and a bit. And that was pretty close to the game, especially with the way the pace of the game being as slow as it was and the way the Cavs aren't scoring. I mean, a 14-point lead with, you know, 6.5 minutes left is, you know, Golden State might have that in them, but I don't think the Cavs team with this roster has that in them.
I agree with you. We should talk about Mozgov's performance, though. He was fantastic, and there are a lot of lessons to be learned by bigs in this league. Even, like, you know, you would think of Mozgov as a relatively unskilled big, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, relatively. I think he's more skilled than probably he's commonly given credit for, but he's not Al Jefferson.
Right. So, but a guy like that can still be very effective when someone smaller is guarding him by just being a bully, posting up right under the basket every time in the restricted area. And that's what he did. And that's how he was able to be so effective. There are so many bigs in the league who, you know, granted they're kind of told to stay out of the way a lot of the time, but it was nice to see a big, even a relatively unskilled big, just say, all right, I'm going to kill you by being big, because so many bigs just get flummoxed by the small lineup. And you don't have to be some unbelievable post score where it's like, all right, we're going to dump it into you and you're going to operate against these guys. You get the ball right at the basket and just turn around and lay it in. But you got to work. You got to work hard on that.
And he was battling. I mean, there were guys hanging off of him. You know, it seemed like there's a guy on each arm, and he just...
Yeah, Green was trying his best to box him out.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like a lack of effort, and Mozgov was just not willing to be moved.
Yeah, no, he played great. Although at the same time, I think that, you know, speed beat size tonight a little bit. And I think that that's, you know, almost illustrative of kind of how the game has changed, both from a skills and almost more importantly, a rule standpoint over the last, you know, decade or so. Would you agree with that?
I would. Yeah, I think. And ultimately, while Mozgov played very well, they were able to get the better of him, and his rim protection was not as good tonight. And the reason for that was that he had to move more before he was able to get in position. Previously, he'd been guarding Bogut, you know, who would be hanging out right under the basket. Now, to get there, he had to move off of Green. That's why he wasn't able to get there, or he picked up some more fouls because he wasn't able to jump straight up. So that was big. And yeah, I think that they did beat him because, you know, three is worth more than two, and they're able to push it through. But on the other hand, if Cleveland's small guys had played better, then maybe, you know, we'd be talking about another close game instead of, you know, feeling like Golden State is kind of in control here. So that said, do you feel that way? Do you feel Golden State is kind of in control now?
The only thing I would say, yes. The only thing is I think that just the energy aspect was so big and was so much in Golden State's favor tonight. And the 2 days between now and Sunday, is really fortuitous. I think it comes for Cleveland just in terms of timing, that's, you know, first of all, 2 days to kind of flush this out of the system a little bit, because not a great performance, obviously. I mean, it wasn't an effort thing. They just couldn't or didn't execute very well. But just to recharge the energy a little bit and let Shrumpert's shoulder heal up as much as possible. And certainly, you know, let LeBron and Delly and, you know, and certainly Mozgov, who earned it, like, get an ice bath for, you know, hours.
I think the Cavs still have one more win left in them in this series. I picked Warriors in seven. I said that I thought it would be the type of series where the Warriors win their games more comfortably and the Cavs would kind of claw, you know, sort of a 2008 Boston-Atlanta type of thing. It looks like it's kind of on track like that so far. This totally makes up for me picking Atlanta to beat the Cavs in the last round.
if I get this right.
I did too, so, you know, we're in the same boat there, so no one listened to us ever again.
So, yeah, I do think that Cleveland can play better. You know, I also think that Andre shot it pretty well tonight. Green shot it reasonably well. We may see them regress, especially Andre, a little bit. You know, his jumper is not exactly the most consistent thing in the world, although he was absolutely wonderful tonight. So, yeah, I'm interested to see what happens on Sunday. But I think, you know, the Golden State is not quite out of the woods yet. As much as you might want to analogize this to that Memphis series, and it does have some sub-merit, but I think this Cavs team has a little bit more, especially offensively, than that Memphis team did.
And do either of us feel comfortable, you know, again, the LeBron factor is still pretty huge, isn't it? Unless we think somehow he used it all up in the first three games, and I don't think that, do you? And that's just such a huge factor that, you know, if he can, he's already completely dominated, you know, just three games of this series, not necessarily just from the box score, just the entire way the game has played out has been how LeBron James said it was going to play out. And, you know, he didn't do that tonight, but I'm not willing to say he's not going to do that, you know, on Sunday. Are you?
I am, because I think Golden State's not going to let him. I think that they're going to force these Cavs role players to beat them. Now, I think the way that it ends up getting close again is the Cavs role guys hit their threes. That's what I think is how the difference is going to be, because Golden State found the formula here, I think. And also now with Andre guarding him the entire time, I think it's going to make things a lot harder for him. So, I mean, I think he's certainly going to play well, but he's not, despite what everyone's saying about this being his greatest achievement, he is not the player that he was 2, 3, 4, even 5, even in his first Cleveland iteration in 2009. You know, that LeBron James would be scoring a lot more efficiently than this one is, frankly. So he's still fantastic. I don't think that he's going to be able to score efficiently in the rest of this series. You know, he hasn't in these games, but part of that's going to be because they're going to focus on him more now and make those other guys beat them. But I think they have it in them to win one more game in this series, because Golden State's not going to change up now and go back to the original formula.
No. Although, I mean, as a counterpoint, though, I mean, you talked earlier about, you know, the Golden State strategy tonight was kind of double LeBron, make him swing the ball and make them reverse it and have someone on the other side of the floor beat them. What happened, even though that's the, quote, right basketball play, what happens, you know, on Sunday if, you know, all right, they double LeBron, kicks it to Dele at the top, Dele throws it right back to LeBron, and he goes back to work. And they didn't look to do that tonight, in part because I don't think LeBron had the energy to kind of, you know, clear space one more time and demand the ball back. And, you know, the question is, if their offense running that way isn't so much about their offense, it's about controlling the pace for Golden State's offense. And if that's what they need to do to take the pace back out of the game, then maybe that's what Cleveland tries to do in game five, and maybe they can do that again, or maybe they can't. But it's something I wouldn't be surprised to see, I guess.
Part of the reason, though, to me, as a counterpoint to that, that the doubles were very effective in this game is because they love to bleed the clock so badly. And LeBron started getting into his ISOs a little bit earlier, later on in the game. But if he's going to, like, pound the air out of the ball, then if you send the double with 5 seconds left on the shot clock, there isn't time to get it back to him. There isn't really time to work it around even for a great shot. You know, he's either going to take a really tough one over a double team, or he's got to throw a flaming bag to one of his teammates. You know, and the Warriors were doubling in a smart way, too, where they were forcing, where they wouldn't, you know, let an easy pass. It was the guy who was left open was on the weak side, so they weren't able to get it to him right away, especially with the late clock. So that's another thing that I think that the doubling does, is it not only, you know, makes James give it up, but it makes him feel like, all right, I can't just take my time all day here now, because if they double late, we're not going to have a play.
That's a good point. Maybe they did speed him up a little bit with bringing those double teams a little bit more aggressively.
All right. Well, so this is probably a good summary for today. Danny says hello, everyone. By the way, he is in Cleveland right now, so wasn't able to make it on. They've been getting back at like 3 a.m. or some completely ridiculous time. So thanks so much for Seth coming on. Anything else that you wanted to add or maybe plug as well, Seth? I mean, you've only written like 97 things over the past week, right? you're probably like the most prolific guy that I follow, I think, in terms of like actually writing stuff instead of just, you know, tweeting and hearing yourself talk the way I do.
Thanks. We have a lot of interesting stuff on nyloncalculus.com, so I check a lot of the stuff out there.
Kind of tell people what nylon, because that's really a site that everyone should be following, by the way. Like, tell people kind of what that is. For a lot of people who aren't aware, it's a little bit more of a niche site, but it's a site that I go to for a lot of my staff.
Sure. It's part of the Hardwood Paroxysm Basketball Network, and it's a site that got founded last summer. It's analytics based, and we've got everyone doing everything from kind of hardcore kind of quantitative modeling of basketball, which isn't my bag, but there's people who are very good at
it. You're more of a softcore quantitative modeling kind of guy.
Hey-o. And draft and kind of stuff like that to kind of very specific breakdowns of shots, good and bad, rim protection, all the different kinds of kind of new and interesting ways we can look at the game with some of the newer kind of stats that are being released with, you know, the synergy data and the especially the sport view data on NBA.com. And I've got some really interesting writers. I'm guy, I'll plug his stuff, who just writes really good stuff all throughout the playoffs, is Justin Willard at Across the Court on Twitter.
What was his piece today? Again, I forget what it was, but I remember that it was really good.
Let me see. He recently had a really good piece, kind of a postmortem on the Hawks season, I thought was really good. And he's talked a fair amount about, he and Neil Payne of 538 both had really good pieces today, talking about how sustainable the Cavs defense so far against Golden State was. And both of their answers was some, but not all. And, you know, maybe we saw some regression to the mean and more tonight. So those are check it out. There's everything from the as nerdy as can be to some slightly more lighthearted stuff with a statistical bent.
All right. Well, so you guys can follow Seth on Twitter at Seth Partnow, PARTNOW. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA on Twitter. Thanks again so much for listening to the podcast. We always appreciate an iTunes rating as well. That helps us keep this going, hopefully into the off season. We will be back on Sunday night, take a couple days off, and we'll be all over Game 5, me and Danny. I know you all have missed him. He and I will be back at it then. Until then, stay safe.